Okay, are there any questions or comments?
Okay, so how does, if you could briefly explain how, like, judgment relates to sin, and if judgment, like, because I know you did the justice versus judgment passage, but, like, because, like, God can't remember our sin, but at the same time it says if we judge, one person then will be judged, so how does that work with, like, the
finished work? Okay. It's a good question. Does anybody know the answer?
Do we suffer, like, loss for that situation, or...?
Yes, we will suffer loss, but more. Because in Romans 2:1, it says, if I judge, then I've done the same things, plural. Not the same thing, but the same things. So if I stand in judgment of another believer, then all of the things that are wrong in their life are taken off of them and put on me. And so Ashley is asking, you know, how does that relate to the finished work?
Like, that's the only way that I could understand it. Didn't see it as like a category of sin, like judgment of sin, because
he can't remember our sin. So if he's giving it back to us, then it's like
in a almost in a different level, and that's why I don't understand.
Okay, whatsoever is not of faith is sin. So it's definitely sin. Okay, if I stand in judgment of another believer, I am actually in sin, in violation of 39 doctrines. And so it's definitely a sin, because it's contrary to faith in every way imaginable. So the question is, why is it that there can be a finished work, but if I judge somebody, their mistakes are brought on me? And the reason is, according to your faith, be it unto you. See, there is this law of faith. According to your faith, be it unto you. Now, you could almost call this, in a manner of speaking, an inverse law of faith. When I stand in judgment, I have to understand what it is exactly that I'm judging. Okay, and what it is that I'm doing. And if I stand in judgment of a believer, then I'm not judging that person per se. I think I am. I think I see, I'll look at that person's life. And then, as Pastor Stevens put it, I think it was a very good observation. People judge according to what they think may be happening or did happen. Not according to actually what did happen, but what they think may have happened or be happening, or whatever the case may be. And so we can't judge that way. We can't judge even if we're standing there watching it happen in that regard. Now, we can come to somebody alone. If I see somebody out, not like, if I see somebody in sin, then I can come to them alone in a spirit of restoration, and that's in order. But I don't take it anywhere beyond that. And nor does God ever take it anywhere beyond that. If I'm in the table of organization as a pastor, then I don't take it beyond the table of organization. As a pastor, if I had somebody in my congregation, and we don't have this right now, thankfully, but if I had somebody in my congregation that I knew was living in sin, then I would have to go to that person and try to restore them. I wouldn't go to that person in a spirit of condemnation or accusation, but in a spirit of restoration. Whether I'd go to that person or not at all is also a question, because maybe just their presence, hearing the Word of God, can be sufficient. When wouldn't I go to a person if it was somebody who's relatively new, for example? And this happened in one of our churches in Europe. There was a couple that came to the church, and they were living together, but they weren't married. They were living and sin. And so the pastor decided not to say anything to them, even though he was aware of it. And that was a wise move on his part. Because I never come to correct somebody if they don't have the capacity for the correction. If somebody doesn't have the capacity for correction, I have to understand something. They're not my responsibility, not even as a pastor. If I come to somebody in correction and they say, no, that's not what's happening, that's where I leave it. Or if I come to somebody and even if they lie to me and perhaps I know they're lying to me, that's still where I leave it. And the reason for that is they're not my responsibility. It's not my jurisdiction, if you will. They're God's responsibility. If they're a believer, then God is the one who corrects them. I don't come to correct anyone. I come to restore. And so that's, and when I say a pastor correcting somebody, that's the whole point, is restoration, not so much like get your act together, but restore them into fellowship. And so that's the motive of the pastor when he comes and perhaps has to deal with somebody if he's doing it correctly. Now, this pastor decided not to, and I think he was absolutely right, and the proof is in the pudding. 8 months later, they were coming to this church faithfully, and 8 months later, they decided, listen, the way we're doing this, going about this, is not right before God. We don't want to separate from each other. I mean, we believe it's real between us and we're supposed to be together, so let's just get married. And they decided to get married. And so the pastor married them. And the lady became his secretary. And so here you have a situation where had he corrected them, he probably would have gone beyond their capacity. They would have felt condemned and left. But because he left them alone. Now, does that mean that he agreed or was willing to tolerate that lifestyle? No, it didn't. It wasn't a question of tolerating a lifestyle. It was a question of allowing somebody to grow in their capacity to where they, of their own accord, would get right with God. Because if they were submissive to him right there, maybe if they had a submissive personality, they might have submitted to him, but it wouldn't really been of their own accord. It really would have been a manipulation. And they would have submitted to the pastor's will, but because it was the pastor's will, not because it was right before God. Now, sometimes that is appropriate. Sometimes we submit to the pastor's will because it is the pastor's will, and we are in a table of organization. But sometimes, like with these types of decisions, I stand before God, and if I can be brought by the pastor to the place where I'll make the right choices that he desires for me to begin with, but he's creative enough to let me come on my own to the place where God does it in me, knowing that that if I stay faithful, that God will work in my heart, then I've actually yielded to the will that He has for me, but I haven't yielded to His will per se in having that be a manipulation of my will. In my own will, I yielded because I knew that this was the will of God, and because He is a godly man, it was also His will for me. And so what He did for these people, this pastor, He helped these people develop the capacity to where they would make the right choices simply because they desired to make the right choices before God, rather than Him telling them, this is what you ought to do. That took 8 months. Some would say that's long, some would say that's short. It doesn't really much matter, because it worked. It took 8 months, and He built their capacity, and not only did they get right with God, but then they also became very deeply knit into the body. And so He used a lot of wisdom when He did that. We have to be careful as believers not to get in this righteous mode where we can't tolerate somebody else's unrighteousness, perhaps out and out sin. But what we see is somebody else's unrighteousness, because then we will become those who judge. Now, to judge is to pass the wrong sentence. To have the wrong assessment and then to pass the wrong sentence. To come up to the wrong conclusions. What is righteous judgment and what is unrighteous judgment? First of all, righteous judgment never goes by sight or by hearsay. If there's something I think that I'm aware of, then I go to that person alone and I ask him about it. And I do that carefully so that I don't accuse them of it, but rather I say, you know, I want to know if everything is okay. How's things going? Are you guys okay? Are you well? Right. For example, let's say that I had somebody in my church that I thought was secretly drinking. Then I would call up to, and I wouldn't say to them necessarily, are you drinking? Because that question in and of itself is an accusation. But I would say to them, how's it going? Right? How's everything coming along? Are you okay? Is everything okay? Do you have, like, see if there's stress in that person's life. See if maybe their family is okay. You know, the things that drive people to drink. And often, if you come up with that kind of an attitude, they'll out and out tell you, yeah, you know, pastor, I'm just really stressed and, you know, I haven't been doing so good. I'm just really stressed out. You know, or things at home are rough right now. You know, just, you know, my kid has been really giving me a hard time. Or, you know, whatever. My spouse is, whatever, sick. Or, you know, it can be any number of things, obviously, right? And then you'd say, so, well, how are you coping with it? Like, how are you dealing with it? Are you able to deal with it okay? And if you talk to them like that, it might take a little bit longer than, are you drinking? But if you say, are you drinking, you seriously risk shutting them down. And that would be counterproductive. And so we have to make sure that we come, as if we are in this position, that we come to them in a spirit of humility and restoration, and not in a spirit of accusation. And that's important. I could not tell them, you've got to stop drinking, unless the Holy Spirit specifically led me. I wouldn't say to them, you've got to stop drinking. Because I'm not going to usurp authority over their life. I might talk to them in principle. But, you know, drinking is like such a devastating thing. You know, maybe we could find another stress release for you. And so that would be kind of coming to them in the proper way. Unrighteous judgment always goes by sight, always goes by hearsay, hearing of the ears, imperfect, partial information. And that's what often makes it unrighteous judgment. Because I'm filling in blanks and coming to conclusions based on how I'm filling in blanks. Well, blanks can be filled in from not the tree of knowledge of good and evil, but from the tree of life also. We as humans, we have this thing in our flesh, is we have this tendency to fill in the blanks to the negative. You ever notice that? People have a tendency to fill in the blanks toward the negative, never toward the positive. Not never, but usually. Usually not toward the positive. Something looks like, I don't get what's going on here, and they'll go to the negative. I think a perfect example of that is what happened to Pastor Stevens. When he was in the back hallway of the church and it was empty, and some woman comes back there, she's walking down, you know, just happens to show up, and she sees Pastor Stevens embracing this woman. And it's not his wife, and she's, you know, married, and he's embracing her, and he's holding her quite closely. And it's like a very, you know, it's like a significant embrace. Now, that woman had a choice right there. And she chose, but she chose incorrectly. And she saw that, and she goes up to him and she says, Pastor, what are you doing? You know, she rebukes him. He was very gracious to her. But she rebuked him. But she rebuked him because she judged him unjustly. What she didn't know is that that woman's husband died that morning. And she left the hospital and went to talk to her pastor. And so she was devastated, and he was being her father. And so he held her as her father and her pastor. Another example, I just heard this message yesterday or the day before. Pastor Ellis, he was a pastor, was out in Tennessee. I don't know if he's still there or not. He preached a message about how everybody needs a father, about fathers, how pastors are fathers. And in his church, he said he's got 30 people lined up to get a hug from their spiritual dad. And he hugs and kisses all of them. And he's 30, and he said that particular day was like 30 young women line up, and they want a hug and a kiss from him because he's their dad. He's their spiritual dad. He loves them like their dad. And this woman, who is just as bitter and sour as can be, she came up to him, and he did the voice, and I can totally hear this. He did the, I'll try to imitate it, but I don't think I'm going to do it justice. She said, "Pastor, you love the young ladies, don't you?" He said, "Yeah, that's right, and if you're not careful, I'm going to love you too." And he gave her a big hug and a big kiss. And he said, now she's number 31. She's lining up every Sunday to get a hug and a kiss from her spiritual dad. And you see, that's unrighteous judgment. And so we judge with righteous judgment. Righteous judgment always operates on the foundational thought in Philippians 4:8. Whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are of a good report. These are the things that we think on. So what it means is these are the things that we have as our frame of reference. Philippians 4:8 frames of references will always judge righteous judgment. When information is incomplete, they won't go to the negative. They won't go to the tree of knowledge at all. They'll go to the tree of life. They will always assume godliness, never ungodliness. And so you judge righteous judgment that way. Now, if a person decides that they're going to stand in the place of being a judge, I see somebody fail and now I'm judging them. God says that He puts those sins on me. And they no longer have that failure. He removes it from their account and puts it in mine. And so now I have to repent of sins I never outwardly performed. Now, this works on many different levels. What is it, from what we've learned just in our church, what is it that happens if I stand in judgment of somebody? Okay, I see something and now I have to contemplate what's going on. And I come to a conclusion. But in that contemplation and in that conclusion, what happens to me? Does anybody know? In that contemplation and conclusion, my mirror neurons are triggered. And by essentially meditating, we always think of meditation as being on the Word of God. Meditation is anything that I dwell on. So by meditating on their mistakes, my mirror neurons are kicking in and I'm experiencing those mistakes physiologically. That's why he had to say to the Pharisees, "He among you is without sin, let him cast the first stone." Why? Because every single one of them was an adulterer in their judgment of the woman caught in adultery. And why? They all had the experience because of their mirror neurons. Same principle as if you even look upon a woman with desire in your heart, you've already committed adultery with her. Okay, same mirror neurons. So we're standing here contemplating somebody's failure, and the mirror neurons are kicking in and we get the experience of that failure. What causes me to go there? Self-righteousness. Why do people get self-righteous? because they are self-elevated. I think this is one of the biggest, most important things that any believer has got to be aware of. We cannot live in self-elevation over another person. If we do, God promises to oppose me and to cause me to fall. Very frequently, people who stand in judgment of other people in the negative sense, because of what their mirror neurons are doing, they're actually training themselves and preparing their own capacity for the same mistakes that those people are conducting outwardly. They're training their own capacity to conduct outwardly those same mistakes. And so somebody judges somebody, let's say somebody falls into adultery. Somebody stands in judgment of them, and 5 to 10 years down the road, they're in adultery. Why? They've prepared their capacity. They've prepared their thinking. And so the sins really are mine. If for no other reason than the mirror neurons. Here's the other part of it. As you judge, so shall you be judged. Right? As you judge, Luke chapter 6, as you judge, so shall you be judged. Judge not, and you will not be judged. As we judge, so shall we be judged. I choose my own judgment. We don't get this. As believers, I'm not sure I ever met a single believer who really gets this. As we judge, so shall we be judged. Now, I can't even say you're an adulterer to somebody because right there my mirror neurons make me an adulterer. Because I have to ponder that conclusion. And we just said, in that pondering, we get the mirror neuron experience, which also does change my epigenome. However, there's more to it than that. It's not just judging because I've judged that way and now I've taken that sin onto myself. There's your Romans 2:1 experience. But I choose my own judgment from God. That's why it says, blessed are the merciful, for they will obtain mercy. I choose my judgment from God. So if I'm somebody who readily hands out mercy, God will readily hand me mercy in my experience. And at the Bema Seat. If I'm somebody who's very gracious and kind to people, even in, let's say somebody fails me and I'm just very gracious and kind to them, then God will purposely be gracious and kind to me. If I'm somebody who is very compassionate and empathetic toward people, God will have a tremendous amount of compassion toward me. On the other hand, if I'm somebody who's self-righteous and judgmental of people, God will make sure that I'm the recipient of that. As we judge, we're going to be judged. And so we choose, we select the judgment, even as believers. We select the judgment with which God judges us. And so, one of the reasons why we can't judge is, okay, now if I judge, it's me, it's my experience, and not maybe outwardly, but that's only a matter of time as my mirror neurons are training my capacity, training my lines of thinking, the neural fibers in the brain, you're getting those connections as the mirror neurons are going, and you know, you've trained yourself. Okay, there's the one thing. Now, I'm choosing my own judgment is another thing, and there's a third thing. Anybody knows what that might be? Third thing is, what am I judging? Let's say I see somebody fall into adultery. Maybe they tell me. There's a good one. Maybe they tell me. Maybe that's like the only way I could really see it, right? Maybe they tell me that they've fallen into adultery. Now, I've got a test here. Somebody comes and tells me that I've got a test. Okay? This is my test. Am I going to judge them? Or am I going to give them the character of God? Now, I could think to myself, if I stand in judgment of the negative sort, unrighteous judgment towards them, I could think to, well, they fell in adultery. And I've always, like, I'll see them and my frame of reference is adulterer. This is one of the reasons why you never, ever disclose your past. Not only because it's gone away, okay, that's the primary reason, because it's actually a lie, but because now, if I disclose a past, let's say that I'm somebody who has, I don't know, maybe I haven't, but let's say for the sake of discussion that I had a drug problem before I was saved. Okay? And I can find, yeah, I had a drug problem before I was saved. I've just seriously hurt that person. I've damaged that person. Because now I have planted in their frame of reference judgment toward me. That I had a drug problem. And they will, unless they can very clearly and very concisely think with the Word of God, and most people can't, then in the back of their head, they're always identifying me as somebody with a drug problem. So I've set them up. I've tripped them up. They won't be able to help that, because I've planted it in their frame of reference. And Satan will be able to take advantage of their life that way, advantage of them, where, you know, he brings up that person as a drug addict or adulterer or murderer or whatever that person may have had in the back of their lives, right? In pre-salvation. Well, that's pretty devastating, because now I'm known to them according to that. Now, here's the major problem with that. That's actually the minor problem with that. There's a major problem with that. Let's say that I now know somebody, and I, you know, they've confided in me, and now I know they were a drug addict, murderer, adulterer, kidnapper, whatever. Well, if I'm standing in judgment of them, it's not in truth, in reality, what's really going on. I'm thinking I'm judging their drug addiction, drug use, adultery, whatever. I'm not. Because it doesn't actually exist if they're a believer. Right? They become a new creature, and if they failed as a new creature, if they have failed after they were born again, the blood of Christ has still completely removed it from them. And God has still completely forgotten it. Nothing exists that God doesn't know about. This is so contrary to the way that we think. Nothing exists that God doesn't know about. People will hear something that says, well, I remember from my past. Show it to me. Does it exist? Show it to me. Well, it did in my past. What past? The only way I can say I remember from my past is to live in a lie. Because nothing exists that God doesn't know about. So this is one of the reasons that I so dislike when people get up there and give their testimonies about how they were in sin and God cleaned them up. Well, you just lied to the entire church or whoever you're talking to. Just give the gospel. Yeah, give the gospel. It's a much better testimony. Just give the gospel. Because nothing exists that God doesn't know about. And they may say, well, I remember, and I was there, and I was a fornicator, an adulterer, a drug addict, I was a kidnapper, whatever it was, a thief. Nothing exists that God doesn't know about. We think that, we still think, as believers, we think we are the definition of reality. If it's in my brain, it's real. God said, cast down vain imaginations and high things. Bring every thought into captivity. Subjugate it to the mind of Christ. Because nothing exists that God doesn't know about. And if He does not know about my sin is non-existent. But here's the thing, God is eternal and I am not. I think to myself, time, so many years ago, God is saying, you're in eternity in Christ. I know way beyond time, and I know the future too, and I know the present. He says, I don't know your sin. Nothing exists that God doesn't know about. Even if it's a believer who fails, because we believers do fail. And we try to scale our failures. Well, the guy cut me off and I used a wordy dirt. And that was a small failure. At least I didn't go out there and kill somebody. We scale our failures. God doesn't scale our failures. A failure is a failure. Whatsoever, whatsoever, absolutely whatsoever is not a fatal sin. Right? 1 Corinthians 14. Nothing exists that God doesn't know about. So, in the past it didn't exist. In the present it doesn't exist. And in the future it doesn't exist. Now, Satan tries to project to our thinking. And he even encourages, and I've heard pastors say this, that it really does exist. Well, if it existed, God would know it, wouldn't He? What do I remember that God does not know? What do I know that God does not know? It shows me that I'm buying into a lie, and the lie came from the father of all lies. So I've received a projection according to a life that I'm not living. It is entirely like those people, and you hear about them once in a while, they all of a sudden have the memories of an 800-year-old Indian or whatever. And if you check the history books, you find that the memories are absolutely accurate. Well, it's a demon whispering to somebody's mind, projecting these things, and especially if they have like a visual thing, they can actually see the thoughts. But they might be a visual thinker. There's a lot of visual thinkers. I'm a visual thinker. And so people receive these projections. Now, let's say that I start judging somebody about something. I don't know even if I'm answering your question. What's the problem with it? I'm judging the blood. That's the thing. I'm judging the blood. See, this is how it ties into the finished work. I think I'm judging the person, but I'm not. I'm judging the blood. Finished work says all things are passed through, all things are become new. Finished work says the works were finished from the foundation of the world. Finished work says the Lamb was slain from the foundation of the world. Finished work says sins have been completely removed. How is it that God can impute them to me? Very simple. If you confess your sin, 1 John 1:9, to God, He is faithful and just to forgive your sin. There has to be an agreement with God in order for me to be back in fellowship with Him. Is it reality? Is it truth? That I should have somebody else's sin imputed to me. Is that truth? Well, I just explained to you why it is. Because in the mirror neurons, I've taken it on myself. And in my heart, remember, God looks at the heart, not the outward appearance. I've actually committed that sin. So yes, it is absolutely reality. In my arrogant attitude of judgment toward another person, I've elevated myself rather than humbled myself. I did not recognize that I was even in sin as I was in sin. I didn't confess, I didn't rebound, I didn't appropriate the blood, I didn't go into restoration, I didn't come to God with my mistake. Instead, I defend my mistake in self-righteousness. And so long as I'm holding on to it, God says it's yours. I refuse to believe in the finished work, and I judge as I was, as I had judged in my experience. There it is. So when I judge, I really get in trouble on three different levels. And those are just the obvious ones. And then there's also the lack of forgiveness that is involved in judgment, where I then become in bondage to another person's failure. Remember one thing. If I don't forgive, God is going to require of me also. We see this as so contrary to the finished work, but it's not. Why is it not contrary to the finished work? Because part of the finished work is that I have a free volition. And if I reject the finished work, I can't just reject part of it, I reject all of it. If I reject the finished work toward you, I reject the finished work toward myself. I become essentially a born again unbeliever, where I'm living in the same experiences as the believer, because God has to oppose me for my pride. So I essentially become a born again unbeliever. Now, I imagine, if this goes on the internet, I don't know yet, but I imagine that there could be people hearing this and they'll have an issue with it. Because finished work to some people is a warm, fuzzy feeling. And this goes against their warm, fuzzy feeling. Shakes up their security a little bit. Rattles their ribcage. But we're first of all talking about experience, not position. Second of all, the finished work has nothing to do with a warm feeling. God is extremely protective of the finished work, even against my unbelief. And so it's not at all contrary to the finished work. It's entirely in line with the finished work, because it is the finished work that even allows me to have a free volition. And God will simply allow me my free volition. But then I get everything that comes with a free volition. Don't want mercy? Don't want to give mercy? Okay, you don't have to have mercy. It's part of the finished work. You don't have to have mercy. Don't want grace? You don't have to have grace. Don't want compassion? You don't have to have compassion. Don't want forgiveness? You don't have to have forgiveness. I'll still go to heaven when I die, if I'm born again. But in my experience, I won't experience any of those things. Nor will I at the Bema Seat. 2 Timothy, I think it's 2:12, says, if I deny him, he will deny me. And so I have to be extremely careful not to deny the things of God, lest he deny me. What? My choice. It's my choice. An imputation of sin to a believer for judging another person is essentially the same as temporarily revoking the benefits of the blood. And it's not that God Himself would desire to revoke, not eternally, not positionally, but experientially, revoking the benefits of the blood. Not that He would bring up the things of my past, those are already gone. But in standing in judgment, I'd conduct the same thing.
So it's essentially the same thing as at that point you were poking God in the eye because you're poking one.
Oh, absolutely.
And then the other one is like when you identify somebody, like that's sort of the identifying, like, oh, that's that, like, I mean, like Christ flat out was like, oh yeah, well, they're a prostitute and they're a harlot, and he flat out like used the same judgment terms, but he didn't do it as like a, that's what you are, you're a horrible person, but he still identified what they were. So people could say that Jesus was judging them, judgment was for the purpose of loving them.
Identification and judgment are two different things.
But you were using the example of if you see somebody and you're like, oh, they're living in adulterous, like in your brain, but you don't say it or whatever. Like, you can say, oh yeah, adulterous, but you really need to be loved up.
There's the difference. Christ would say to them, as they are in it, you're in this. But He doesn't know them after that.
Yeah, but that can be an initial point. Like,
if the woman living in living with five, that had five husbands, He identified it to her. You've had five husbands. She was currently in that situation. But He did not know her for eternity, woman with five husbands, woman living in sin.
She was recording the Bible like that for all eternity.
Yeah, but notice her name wasn't. Okay. That's the thing. And so her name was, you know, right now, even though the Word of God is forever established in heaven, He does not know her as woman with five husbands. That's the point. He knows her as forgiven.
That's a fair comment, I guess. Well, I mean, isn't generally judgment, I guess, is like we understand it more like empirical and, you know, 10% and everything, but Christ was the God-man. So, you know, it was like entirely a faith that wasn't...
Yes.
He wasn't using His eyes, it was completely...
Yeah. That's absolutely right.
That's what I'm speaking about. Well, I'm not asking God's perspective. I'm asking, especially I'm asking temporal wise, because like the question I'm currently on is like, but you can like, I mean, you can go to the inner city and you're like, oh, you're a prostitute, I'm gonna have an outreach to you. Like, you flat out identify people as being, oh, this is the type of sinner I'm going after. Like, you obviously know what they did by just by the name, not that you can dwell on it, not that you think about it, not that you're on their own, have to be involved. But, like, you can flat out identify it as if you were to identify a rock. You can say sin, service. But,
yeah.
But
that's still not judgment.
So, but if somebody was... So the flip side of that is if somebody is living in it and is like constantly attacking that person in their mind every time they see them, then obviously they're thinking about it to a greater degree than just putting a label.
It's easier to conceive it this way. Let's say that a woman came into the ministry who was a prostitute, got saved, got right, and somebody got wind of it. And then they would, in their mind, think prostitute. That's judgment.
Okay. And then... at that point, they're obviously attacking God's children, and that person is maybe saved, is not saved.
The person who's judging?
Yeah.
They may very well be.
May or may not be saved, but God is.
Well, saved people do this sometimes.
But wouldn't that be pride instead of judgment? Because
judgment has its root in pride. Judgment has its root in pride. Self-righteousness. And it makes sense. Pride comes before a fall. In other words, God is more interested in my humility than my outward righteousness. Right? Because outward righteousness comes as a result of humility. And so I may think that I have a form of godliness, but I'll deny the power thereof. And if I deny the power of godliness, eventually I'll enter into ungodliness. That's what the Pharisees did. The Pharisees were so zealous for God that they crucified him. Because they weren't actually zealous for God at all. They just saw it that way. Right? Well, control, position, but ultimately self-righteousness. Self-righteousness is perhaps, well, it's outright. Self-righteousness is the worst of all the sins in Proverbs chapter 6. The worst sin is a haughty look. A haughty look is a self-righteous manifestation. That was the pride that led to the iniquity that got Lucifer kicked out of heaven, of self-righteousness. It's brutal stuff. Never, this is one thing, we have to remember this as believers, as humans. Never think of yourself too highly. Never think of yourself too lowly either. Really, just don't think of yourself. But there's this tendency sometimes, especially among those who are well taught, and this was the Ephesian problem, that they thought of themselves too highly, and they looked down their nose at other people. And in truth, they were in much worse condition than they realized. They were in worse condition than the Laodiceans. What's that? They're the only ones who got their candlestick removed, and then they did lose God's presence, and there has never been a significant Christian presence in Ephesus since. Any other questions or comments or anything? Yeah.
I noticed there was one part where you were talking, or it was like, you know, for believers or something, the judgment. That goes for unbelievers as well. I mean, like a believer judging an unbeliever who's in sin or something.
Unbelievers are in much more precarious straits than believers. Because of the blood, because for Christ's sake, I personally think God is very, in situations like this, God is much more likely to be very patient with a believer, much more so than an unbeliever. Because an unbeliever, he doesn't even know. Now, if it's God is not unkind. He died for them also. So if he knows that if you just wait and let them do that, yes, it'll, my believer will receive rewards for this. And this will be used in their own life to build them. See, God never works on one level. He may allow unbelievers to do a lot. But ultimately, if it's not something that will lead to their own salvation, then it's going to lead to a much greater destruction. There's an inverse reality. You know how some may obtain a better resurrection, and Paul was shooting for a good resurrection and all this stuff. There's also greater hell. And we always think, well, hell is hell, right? Mm-mm. Just like heaven heaven is heaven, right? Yes and no. Heaven is what it is. Heaven is heaven. But not everybody's experience in heaven is the same. And yet, hell is hell. Not everybody's experience in hell is going to be the same. Just like some will have a much greater capacity to be blessed by God and receive rewards, some have a much greater capacity for eternal suffering. And so we can't, you know, we can't just say, well, hell is hell and heaven is heaven. Well, on one level it's true, on another level it's not. The experience in those places is not the same from one person to the next. In heaven, everybody's happy, has joy to the greatest capacity. Capacities vary. In hell, everybody suffers to the greatest capacity. Capacities vary. The thing that blows my mind, and this is like a thought that I can't, personally I have to be very careful with, because if I go too far with it, it becomes overwhelming, is that the people that are in hell are going to be there forever, and it's not going to end. There's no end. Quadrillion years from now, still there, still suffering. However many zeros you want to put behind the years, still there, still suffering. And they will wish with all their heart that they could die, but they can't. Still there, still suffering. You know, I think about that and I say, God, make me a soul winner. Yeah, you know, I look at people, just, you know, like, look at people, like at that convention, that one guy screaming down, no, no, we don't want God, we don't want Jerusalem, we don't want God. Well, if he doesn't get saved, it makes his offense, his anger, whatever, resentment, negativity toward God insignificant when you consider that hexillions of years from now, a hexillion years from now, still there, still suffering. But not just suffering, torment. There's a lake of fire. Like, have you ever burned your finger on a candle or on the stove and it really hurt? That's their eternity, not with their finger, but with their whole being. That just blows my mind. And the other thing that blows my mind is they chose it. But in some cases, they chose it because they didn't know what else to choose. It always amazes me when Jesus was talking about, what was it, Capernaum? And he said, it will be more tolerable in the day of judgment for Sodom and Gomorrah than for you. It will be more tolerable in the day of judgment for Sodom and Gomorrah than for you. And what did he say? If they had what you had, they would have turned. That shows me that there are people who, if they had what I had, would have turned. And maybe they never turned just because they never got what I have. That freaks me out a little bit. That's like, I gotta be a soul winner. God, make me a soul winner. God, make me a soul winner. Like, if you call me to the field, don't let me hesitate to go. If you call me here, don't let me, whatever the field is, this is the field. Wherever you call me, don't let me hesitate to go. God, make me a soul winner. I think we don't get it. Who was it? Was it Pastor Shavai? Somebody said it the other day. I think it was in church. Maybe it was on a tape, but I think it was in church. 10% of believers soul win, and only 1% of believers teach other believers to soul win. 10% of believers soul win, and only 1% of believers teach other believers to soul win. That's amazing. Any other questions or anything?